Okay, so good to see you again, my brother. I love your tie. We're going to have to get a close-up of that. You got Jefferson, Franklin, Lincoln, Grant.
Yeah.
That's a good tie. And the American flag and a dollar bill or two. And
Jackson.
Jackson. And in the audience, welcome. Very, very much the conversation. A deep and good personal friend of mine and a friend of the world. He had done a number of programs with in the past. That's Kai Hayner, PhD, and he's the director of the Henry George School, located here in New York City. He's a scholar of a high order. It's very tuned into the lessons of economic thinking and extended political organization and societal organization of human society that was enunciated by Henry George. We're going to be talking about that and highlighting a book of his by a Herman von Berg, which we'll get into, but hi, Kai, so good to see you. Welcome very, very much to the conversation.
Thank you, Harold. Always glad to be here.
I think it's worthwhile, particularly now. We're talking on the 7th of October of the year 2010, and the whole nation, the whole world has been roiled by another economic catastrophe and so forth, and we're still suffering the effects of that and that
yep.
sort of thing. One of the things that might be worthwhile going over is Henry George and his take on economic theory and also economic practice as it applied to the world of the roughly the end of the 19th and over into the 20th century, which was a radical take that was not Marxian, but was then perhaps relevant to a world that since the implosion of the Soviet Union in 1989, the Marxian analysis would held sway over those who were in opposition to the capitalist system in place. Has been undercut by this book that Berg said that leaves us with some new interpretation of a model that is not Marxian in opposition to the inordinate the inappropriate organization of world society by the economists and so forth as terms of the people writ large. That's a large thing we have. Share with the audience a little bit in a way Henry George and his contribution and his understanding of economics and of sociological or historical suggestions about how a society ought organize itself and along what principles and why, if you could.
I'd be glad to.
Mm-hmm.
Henry George was a self-made man. He was born 1839,
mm-hmm.
died 1897, ran for mayor of New York City twice in 1886 and 1897. First time he beat Theodore Roosevelt, and he was beaten by the Tammany Hall candidate Abram Hewitt. And some people say the ballot boxes with his name in, they were going down the Hudson. So he was cheated out of the election. That's not a new phenomenon.
That's not new at all. Elections have been, that's a big issue. Yeah, but that's...
And he in 97, he died a few days before the election actually happened in October 29th. And he became actually a hero of... the little guy in the street. He sailed around the world twice as a young man. He,
mm-hmm.
he skipped school at 14, jumped ship in San Francisco, had more adventures under his belt before he turned 20 than most of us will ever have in our entire life.
Yeah.
Jack London describes these kind of fellows, 19th century self-made men.
Mm-hmm.
Worked his way up, went gold digging in Klondike up in the Yukon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't get any gold.
Mm-hmm.
If he had gotten any gold, we never would have heard a word from him.
He might have just lived in comfortable recluse.
He would have gone to the Bahamas and sipped martinis the rest
mm-hmm.
of his life. So
mm-hmm.
he came back stone broke. And worked his way up out of unemployment, became a printer. Wrote letters to the editor. The letters to the editor were so brilliant that the editor-in-chief finally kidnapped him and said, you shouldn't be a printer, you should be an editor.
So now, let's pause for a second then. He wrote letters to the editor. Now, being in a certain sense myself a student of Marshall McLuhan and understanding language, you're writing editors, and you we're going to do another program with another writer today. And so writing is in a certain sense a generic term, and what I'm trying to get at is there are people who write very well.
Yeah.
People who can use the language, marshal the language very well in a very meaningful way. That could be for the new book Freedom by Frenzen. He writes well. He knows how to use the language when you say a writer.
Yeah.
But then there's also the question of what is a person writing about?
Yeah.
And when he ran for New York City, and he also not only gained, if I understand correct, and I think it is, he gained not only the attention of the man in the street, whose cause he was in a certain sense championing,
yes,
but he also won the acclaim and the recognition of what was in a certain sense the leading intellectual elements of world society at that time, including Leo Tolstoy, Mark Twain, and a whole lot of other people.
Absolutely.
Who were drawn to him, not because he was a great writer like Melville or something, which he was able to marshal the language, or Churchill could marshal the language, but it was in a large measure his message that he was sending in the writings, editorially or otherwise, about how the world should be organized, particularly economically, which was in opposition to the conventional wisdom of the time. Is that not correct?
Absolutely correct.
And is that not something we want to try and get to?
Absolutely.
Because we need some sort of an alternative now in the year 2010 that we don't have.
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah. So maybe I just wanted to make that point, if you understand.
Absolutely. What happened is in his 30s, he had an epiphany, and that epiphany came when he was riding out into the hills of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And he was riding with a friend, and a cowboy was coming by, and he asked young Henry George on horseback, asked that cowboy, who does the land we are riding on here belong to?
Okay, the land.
Mm-hmm. And the cowboy said, this land belongs to whatever great landowner, one owner.
Mm-hmm.
And George looked around, and until the horizon, it was all one landowner, and the cows were as small as mice at the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
So George, it struck him like lightning. If we allow this kind of land monopolization and resources monopolization, we will never have social justice. We will never have a just society. And that was from that epiphany. He went back. He studied classical economics. He had worked as a reporter. He has worked at an editor,
right.
And he had seen social injustice.
Like, yeah, and he was very sensitive to that.
That's one overlap with Karl Marx. Karl Marx worked for the Neue Rheinische Zeitung. Henry George worked for the San Francisco Post. So mm-hmm. they both saw the wounds of the time, the social issues of the time, close
and
up.
And economic.
Economic issues of the time, social and economic issues, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so he went back and he started. He was an autodidact. He'd left school at 14, as I said.
An autodidact.
Autodidact.
A very good term. Self-taught. Somebody running down the hair
exactly.
like a fox.
Exactly.
Because they're really motivated by their own, rather than doing what somebody else is telling them they should do in a rote way, which is too much of what education is about.
Absolutely.
But another side.
But that's exactly what it is. So he actually didn't have some weird professor he had to kiss up to.
Right.
He just could do his own research.
Right.
And he went to the libraries and he studied Ricardo, mm-hmm. Mill, Smith, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And he absorbed the principles of classical economics.
Okay.
And he took the principles of classical economics and just geared them towards a just society.
Toward a just society where the resources were not owned by plutocratic individuals who had a vast control and over the means of production, maybe to use the term Marx would do, and that he recognized, did he, I wonder, not only in terms of the dialectic of argumentation going on in the 19th century, but as he cast his eye over the whole of human history, there's always been a certain class, whether it's emperors in Rome, pharaohs in Egypt, kings and earls in the feudal period of Europe and so on, a small group of people who it's assumed are legitimate historically in terms of the evolving human scenario, who have all the power, and the power comes from the ownership of the land.
Yep.
Or the ownership of the resources that gives them an advantage in order to coerce or co-opt the serfs who were under them. It wasn't just the 19th century, although it was getting worse in Dickensian sense with the Industrial Revolution in a sense. But do you understand, to make the point, it's always been like that. And so they're taking a critique not only of the 19th century situation like Marx, but the whole of the human history in a certain sense. Did he reach out back to those loops and see it as something that we need something really very new in terms of understanding how societies are going to be organized? Or do you understand the point
of
the question?
Absolutely. Unlike Marx, he was free market. Unlike Marx, he was against the command economy. Unlike Marx, he was against big government. He said, have a free market, But the free market has to be based on fair access to resources and resources allocation. Now, give me an example. If somebody owned the air in this room that we are both breathing, and we have to pay a nickel every time we breathe, and we're running out of nickels, we are dead.
They would make a lot of money.
They would make an enormous
amount of money. Because we would be desperate to pay.
Because we cannot not breathe. Mm-hmm. We don't have the option not to breathe, because that's a precondition of life. Maslow's pyramid of need, it's a precondition of life. We need air, water, food, shelter, and clothing.
And that farmer or that cowboy who owned that great vast tract of land could have owned that as a private property right. The institution of private property, the validity of it, is what's been argued about by a lot of economic theorizing, even right up till now. And he was not against the idea of private property. Marxists tended to associate, like the the labor theory of value, the input of production is from labor, and they've argued surplus labor theory of value, and they argued against, or would do, argued against the institution of private property ownership, saying everything should be owned by everybody in the name of, and it just happens to be that all that ownership and power and wealth and power politically would be in the hands of a government that would represent all the people, and so therefore you would have a system where you could have justice by doing away with individual greed. That was the critique of the Marxists, it seems. And then you ended up with the nomenklatura and a state capitalism like in Stalin and so forth. But again, trying to get to a large picture, and what do you think is that of that analysis? The institution of private property, you said he was in favor of the free of a market.
Henry George was very strong on private property rights. He said, whatever you produce is yours, whatever I produce is mine. What neither you nor I produce, nor anyone else, that we have to run or administer in common, like the air, because that's a precondition of life.
The land?
The land is for the classical economists, just the overarching term that takes in all natural resources.
That was the basis air of the feudal system with the land ownership and so forth. And the serfs just went along with it.
Now, we're living in the United States of America, and we had a revolution in 1776 where we did away with primogeniture, meaning the automatic passing on of the property, landed property from father to son,
Not only primogeniture.
And we did away with that. That was our revolution.
Well, primogeniture, but we also did away with the system of dynastic order.
Exactly.
Where
we did away with blood aristocracy. Yeah. All of this we did away with. We are a democratic country.
And that was signaling a change that was coming along with not only Adam Smith in 1776, but the steam engine presaging an industrial revolution that we've been living through ever since.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so that's a point that we would make, right? The institution of private property, is it got a place? Does it have a place or not? Is there a market critique of what we have now going in the name of market capitalism that is being advanced? Is there a critique needed now? The Soviet Union has imploded and so forth, but that we're sort of getting ahead, but I wanted to put him in the context as a major figure for an alternative view of economics that the world is grappling with now, that we ought to repair to, because if we had followed his nostrums or his ideas, I wager to say we probably would not have had the Great Depression or the thing we're going through now, and we would have, in a certain sense, given 100 years of under his view of things, we probably would have had a just world order. That is what we're hoping we might be able to arrive at, but are stumbling over outdated institutions that we have followed in the intervening period from when he introduced an idea that was important in a systems way toward the forward movement of society on the planet.
What is absolutely exceptional about George, and you nailed that down correctly, what is absolutely exceptional about George is he understood the importance of resources. In the mid-19th century, 100, 120, 130 years ago, at a time when nobody was thinking about resources.
They were so vast in this continent,
Until the 1890s, we had free land in the United States. You could come, the population density was so low that whoever came from whatever country as an immigrant would always get free land.
The homestead. That was a very bump up. That was a slight bump up that occurred, and it was closed when they closed that. To where the assets were, the assets or the land, let's say, They were all owned by, the tendency was for all the capital assets or productive assets are owned by a tiny plutocratic class. They used to be kings, now they're bankers or they're capitalists and so forth.
But as long as you had free land, you could sidestep that.
Yeah, that's Turner's frontier and all that.
Thank
yeah.
you. Until the 1890s, when that frontier was closed, it was literally true, this is the land of unlimited opportunities.
Yeah.
It was unlimited in the material sense.
All you had to do was go out and steal it from the American Indian peoples, which we did.
Which is a
Holocaust.
Which is another discussion about the genocide on the First Nations. That's
but
true.
Those genocides go back through history. Oh.
But the population density was not such.
Yeah, right.
That's right. It wasn't enough for everybody.
It was probably true when the caveman first appeared 200,000 years ago. We had an old earth. All the resources were there. The oil, everything was there, and they were in a cave, and they had no resources. They had no knowledge. They had to learn how to make a little knife and a club and all that. So that metaphor probably holds throughout the whole existence of Homo sapien on the planet. The resources were essentially all there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, with the population density mushrooming from when Malthus wrote about his on overpopulation in 1897, mm-hmm. 1898, mm-hmm. population was estimated 1 billion on the planet. I would say it was more like 500 million.
Okay.
Now,
really? Okay.
We're coming close to 7 billion this decade.
They're heading for 10, I think. The UN says if we another, don't blow it up.
Another. So then what that means is if we're heading for 10 in the next decade or two, then we have 20 times the population that we had when Malthus was writing.
Right.
Malthus
right.
did not think that the Earth could support, the resources of the Earth could support more than 1 billion people.
Well, he proposed that the population increases geometric while the means of the resources or market or the production increases arithmetically. And a lot of people take some heart in that he may have been wrong, because we would have been bred off the planet by now if those had held in an exponential way. But it tends to be that the more society has become industrialized and, let's say, get moving toward an improved material lifestyle and so forth, they cut down on the family size. And the UN figure for 10,000 assumes that it's going to level off then. So that would be something that it's going to self regulate that population growth, but Malthus, I don't think holds. I don't know, but
the problem with Malthus is Malthus was wrong in thinking that the Earth could not support more people,
right.
more than 1 billion.
Right.
Now Malthus put his finger on the right issue in the sense that he saw that population was going to be an issue, and if you take, let's say, just assume for the sake of argument, today we have 20 times more people than we had in 1798.
Right.
If that is so, that means on the average, resources are 20 times more expensive, because natural resources value is a function of population density. Low population density, low price of resources, high population density, high prices of resources.
I guess that's true. My supply and demand, yeah.
And Henry George is the forerunner mm-hmm. of the environmentalists and the ecologists.
Mm-hmm.
He understood, as I said, in the mid-19th century, he mm-hmm. understood the importance of resources when it wasn't scarce yet, when they were not scarce yet.
Okay. That's interesting. Yeah, okay.
And that means we can safely ascertain today that all wars are wars over resources.
Okay. Could we make another little distinction?
Sure.
You say resources, so we're talking about natural resources. Usually we think land and then minerals, oil,
gas,
bauxite, all the things,
air,
natural resources.
Any kind
But why do we differentiate natural resources, if we take it that way, from, let's just say, means of that's part of a combination of things, including institutions and buildings and this kind of thing that are not natural resources but are capital assets now as we think about it, like real estate and shopping malls and trips to the moon and that kind of thing. Why do you want to limit it only to the natural resources like copper, raw materials?
Well,
do you not tie it into the capital assets that are part of the productive process?
the classical economists distinguish clearly between land and resources on the one side, okay, and capital assets on the other side.
Okay.
Capital are tools. Capital in the language of the classical economists were tools, machinery, technology, and such.
Right, that's part of the productive process, and natural resources are part of the mix of what is used to make products that serve humanity and so forth. That's what I'm saying.
It's natural resources are raw materials for the means of production.
Well, okay, so you want to distinguish raw materials. Like
I'm not distinguishing.
The classical economists did.
No,
well, the classical economists were in another time and all that. We're talking, and so what we're trying to get at is something relevant now, and it's very important. You can own land, or you can own the Empire Building sitting on top of the land. They're both part of the human scenario, and they're owned in a private property way, or can be. Or they can be regulated by government.
What's the difference between the two?
So why make the distinction between natural resources like bauxite that has to be treated with factories and all of that and the actual economic base of the society?
The reason why we're in the environmental devastation we're in today, mm-hmm, the reason why we have the planet in such a precarious state,
mm-hmm,
is because this distinction wasn't made anymore.
The distinction between natural resources and man-made resources.
Exactly.
Okay, that's important. Let's get at it. Yeah. Okay.
Who made the land? Who made the natural resources? Who made the raw materials? Nobody.
Well, that came out of the natural order. Some people call it God and all of the things.
That's
that
fine. It comes out of nature, and it's not something that was man-made. Anything.
Right.
So,
okay,
because it's not man-made,
right,
because again, air and water are preconditions for life. If air and water are privatized, that means if somebody monopolizes all the air and all the water on this planet, this corporation would have would rule over life and death of everybody on the planet.
Oh, yeah.
And that is something that no human being should have over another human being.
That's
totalitarianism, that's fascism.
Right, okay, yeah, okay, that's good, that's very good. You get that. But then that makes the that makes a situation over the natural. They had a thing at our founding fathers in that time we're talking about. They had a thing. John Locke and some of the others out of the Scottish and or the had this idea of natural law. It was very big, very big. Sui generis, individual liberty. They say in the Constitution, rights that are given by nature's law or nature or God or whatever, unalienable,
and
they're not able to be violated. So that was beginning to dawn in the human consciousness and the revolution being made in the United States of America, presaging the Industrial Revolution that was being made by this country that probably has a model that most of people think of in terms of the way a society should be established now, called a republic. That has a thing like that. So that was addressed then at that time.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned the Founding Fathers, because for us, the Founding Fathers are great statesmen, great politicians. One reason why I have this tie on.
I noticed the tie. You got to get a shot of this tie, fellas. You know, it's really something else. That's good. Have you got that trademarked or anything, or is that off the market, right?
What we when we're thinking of the Founding Fathers, we're thinking of great statesmen.
Yes,
and great
indeed.
Philosophers, great political philosophers. They were also, all to the man, great economists. Franklin, Paine, Jefferson, they wrote on economics in a very clear way, and they're all to the man, going back to the Physocrats. And the Physocrats are the French economists who say the first thing that's important in considering an economy is nature and raw materials.
Okay.
So all the Founding Fathers, unlike the British Empire at the time, Empire, they were all mercantilists. The mercantilists, Ricardo was not a mercantilist. Pre-classical economists, all wealth
empire
comes from trade.
Right.
And these were hired hands that would just increase the wealth of the ruling class, of the nobility of the royalty.
Now, the nobility was done by primogeniture, as you say, and by the divine right of king, and they thought of themselves as legitimate.
Exactly.
So here in the United States, they were setting up a thing. How does it relate to the private property principle back again in terms of the Founding Fathers, and that how did it get to be where the rulers of the society, do we agree, you and I, that we live in a plutocracy, that the capital assets, I include within capital assets land, and then all the things that human beings have produced as well. That's a distinction. That's why I don't quite see why we limit it only to public to natural resources, and that it's really a thing of all the man and natural resources in combination, including good design and other kinds of things. But our system is not one that it puts all the power into a plutocratic class, and it's run by bankers and so forth that run the world. And we haven't, what would have been different if we had gone with George, say, at the turn of the 19th century, 20th century? How would the society be different, and how would it be structured? And then, of course, you understand, I like Kelso, and we got to get to Mr. Berg, because he critiques the labor theory of value. I would like to critique the labor theory of value as holy writ in terms of economics, in terms of distributing all buying power to the citizens by their labor participation, whereas the few people own everything, like the kings, they own all the capital assets. The people have no ownership of anything. They only claim they have on an income in order to buy bread and be able to clear the market is they're having a job like a serf on a feudal estate, and the template's all set by it just as it did in feudal times, by the people who own all the assets, including the natural resources, and they're like serfs on a feudal estate, and the technology is undercutting labor's input to production that they base Marx on. So those are some things I'd like to get to. You know, I like Lewis Kelso.
No. You want me to answer the question?
Yes, please, if you can. I'm trying to get to a picture of where the hell are we going from here now, and how did we get here?
Your first question was, how would this a world look under George's...
Yeah, that's something.
Let's start with that, and then
we
go on.
Yeah, we got to get to Mr. Berg, and okay. A critique of the surplus labor theory of value, and a critique of the labor theory of value that sits with George.
No, you want Kelso first, or you want George first?
Well, George.
Okay. If governments had implemented George's philosophy,
yeah.
Which was partially done in 1912 by Sun Yat-sen, who was a Georgist.
Right, in China.
From 1912 to 1925, and then from 1925 to 1949, it was carried on by Chiang Kai-shek, his brother-in-law. The idea is you hold resources, you give access to resources in taxing them. All taxes are taken from production because any tax on production, that's George's revolutionary theory, mm-hmm. different from all other economists. Mm-hmm. George says whenever you tax production, you're basically committing highway robbery to the producer. And in the term producer, Henry George includes the laborer and the capitalist. Labor and capital are not in opposition to each other. They're not antagonistic. That's another big distinction between George and Marx. Labor and capital.
And Kelso? And Kelso?
Labor and capital are on the same side.
That's a huge assumption.
That's very different from what we have been used to.
Right.
Now, if labor and capital are on the same side, there's really no reason to say if you're productive, you tax 30% of your productive value, that means you have 30% less to reinvest. That's a loss to the private individual owner, and it's a loss to society at large.
In a society that needs capital formation capability
to advance technology. Thank you.
Yeah,
so he says complete, not cut of taxes, eradication of taxes, no taxes on production. In that sense, Henry George has a no-tax policy. So he says, now, on the other hand, how can we get infrastructure, how can we get social services, how can we get education, and so on?
Yeah.
Things that society needs that are not provided by individuals. We just had the example of the fireman let a house burn down because the guy had lapsed on his
$75 on a
so let the house burn down.
Yeah.
Henry George says you just levy a user's fee on the resource that is being used. You can buy a piece of land, that's fine, that's yours, and you just pay a tax to the society once a year for that use of land. But you put buildings on it, you put a factory on it, you put whatever else you want to put on it, capital gains, mm-hmm. Income tax are all waived. So what would happen is a huge boost and boom of the economy would happen because of this enormous tax cut.
Because would that be a tax cut that would allow for capital formation by entrepreneurs and so forth
more easily?
Of course. If you don't do that, what's you're going to tax income as we came to
Well, that's the mess we're in right now.
Yeah,
that's
you say
the mess
so.
We're in, that's the mess we're in right now.
Well, we've been in a mess like that throughout all of human history. A few people owning everything, concentration
not
of
true,
wealth
not,
and
not
power.
True, not true, not true, not true. The ancient Egyptian societies, Mesoamerican societies did not have that. Taxation of this kind of taxation system that we have today, plus taking land and resources as absolute private ownership, was a Roman idea. Pre-Roman societies do not have that. First Nations don't have that. First Nations have the earth is given to us by money to us, given to us by nature, and that's a gift, and we take what we need and we leave it what we don't need.
How do you define the we in that we take it? I mean, the Marxists defined it as everything
comes
to the government.
The tribe.
Well, did
the,
we do
the,
away
the First
with any
Nation,
individual?
The tribe, the Iroquois, the Samuels, the Mohawks, whatever,
yeah,
was the unit of choice.
Well, okay. Okay, yeah, they were nested in nature. We were nested in nature on the Serengeti Plain and that sort of thing. But then there came that. So you would tax the land, is that it? You say you'd have a land tax and it would be, is that to raise government funds for social services in a governmental
any kind of what is covered by income tax and capital gains tax today would be covered by resources tax.
What would be the difference? I mean, what? How would they
the
define?
The difference would be that we don't stymie production. We do not stymie production. If
we do not what?
Stymie. We do not
stymie.
We do not. We do not stymie or stymie production, and that means we have a large boost of production.
So
at the same
want,
time, because uh-huh. because we have natural resources users fee, we will treat natural resources carefully because they're not free. One problem was that from classical economics to neoclassical economics, neoclassical economics is reductionist in the sense that it reduced the three-factor economics from classical economics to two-factor economics, and they excluded nature. Nature is an externality.
Well,
it is an externality, mm-hmm. It means it's not being calculated, it's not being figured into the equation, it's not being reckoned with, and consequently, we have the mess we have today.
Okay, well, I see that in a way. Hazel Hunterson talks great about that because the ecological concerns, they take everything externalities in terms of the two-factor theory.
That's a disaster.
My man, who I like, along with Bucky Fuller and other things, sort of in a comparison with him from George in the 19th century, now the turn of the 20th and 21st, is that Lewis Kelso, as you know, with others, comprehensive thinkers and so forth, he called it two-factor. And he just said, I think what
like
he did,
all other 20th
like
century
all,
economists.
Well, all right, like all other 20th century economists. And he had written earlier a book called The Capitalist Manifesto.
With Mortimer Adler.
The preeminent American philosopher lent his imprimatur and everything like that. But it wasn't paid attention to very much because it's very inconvenient to the power relationships of realpolitik and everything.
It was very much a Cold War thing.
But he
They had to go against the communists. It was like McCarthy was raging, and so they had to say the communists did a manifesto that was wrong, so we're doing our manifesto.
Well, yeah,
it was
but
very
the
much in that
yeah, but
Cold
getting
War.
To behind the exactly manifestos, the even political realities that emerge. What's behind it is this idea of the labor theory of value. Lewis used to argue it was all one factor. Everything was one factor,
and what's the
and
one
it was
factor?
Labor. Everything, all the economies are set up to where you have one group of people owning everything, the means of production, whether it's natural resources or not, or also the capital instruments coming out of a mix between the two, and that was the way, and that's the way societies are all set up. Essentially, it doesn't matter. They were arguing about that. And then along came Marx and argued that you had the labor input and that all production comes from labor. You can't do anything without human labor in terms of building upon it. So then he said it's all one factor, and that's the way it is. In the United States, they take so much out through the taxation. A person who has a piece of ownership in the productive capability of the world economy, national economy, they only get about 1/8 of what they actually produce. It's taken away in income taxes, Social Security, all these things are done by government, and it's done. And then also, it's perfectly accepted that it's perfectly all right for all the assets to be owned, and that means natural resources, as well as the productive assets created by human activity, to be owned by a tiny plutocratic class of people, and that the only way the people are going to have income is to have a job, a labor relationship to production, And then now that's being undercut by, you remember, Keynes's letter to his grandchildren, or Aristotle. Yeah, Aristotle, yeah. There was a slave system. They've all been slave systems. The guy with the club could beat everybody into submission and everything. And so then they get that and they say, it will ever need be so until the loom learns to weave. The loom is learning to weave. The technology, the extensions of consciousness in combination with the resources, we got nanotechnology coming. New materials that are 1,000 times as strong as steel and 1/100th the weight. I mean, major breakthroughs that are going on. And but the only way they have to get income to the poor dears is to have a job. They'll set the template for all the structure of society. They'll divide it all up, and then they will provide little surf people to have a little job that they can get something back for what they do. The labor, the input, the labor. And human nature gets its sense of identity from having a job that gives them a sense of all of this. And it's the production, it's the capital assets in conjunction with the natural resources that are being utilized that are owned by a tiny class, and there's no way to have an alternative way of distributing buying power into the masses, and that's what it's a demand-side thing. And Mr. Keynes said it's going to be undercut by our technological advancement. He said that by massive technological unemployment. That's the only way we have to get income. And it's all you hear them talking about. Jobs, 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 jobs. You got to have a role, Mr. Cerf, on the estate. Don't think about owning any of the things that actually are producing the wealth increasingly in a ratio with labor. And that's the problem. To me, the major problem is the labor theory of value. You seem not to think that, or you think it's back in taxing natural resources as opposed to all the aspects of production, including, you know, the means of production. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Henry George would agree with Kelso.
Oh, good.
As to that ownership society, what is it, ESOP, employment, stockholder, what is it, stock?
Well, the way they have the...
What's the ESOP? What's Kelso's ESOP?
Employment, stock ownership plans. There's some of that, but it's relatively strong. And it's not accepted. It's not accepted in a major way like you would have wanted
If you let me explain why Henry George would agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
In creating this ESOP, Kelso puts the worker and the capitalist in the same boat, on the same side, as owners.
That's true, if it's working right.
And that is what Henry George is doing with the concept of the producer. So they are totally in sync on that.
The only problem, if I may, with the ESOP, it is employee. It should be for the general society. It's not the employee. That was just the tip of the iceberg. In a systems way,
ownership should be distributed to everybody, not only
the natural resources, but the whole productive process as a way of distributing income rather than depending upon labor.
I don't have
the labor theory of value that's the problem.
I don't have an argument with that.
And that's what Mr. Berg, we got to get
And we're getting to that. Yeah. Now, Kelso mended the ESOP with CSOP, meaning consumer ownership.
There were eight different ways. The people of the city should own Consolidated Edison. The people that
if
have
it's the consumer, everybody's a consumer, that means everybody becomes
that's
an
right,
owner.
That's right, and down the line. Everybody should be an ownership. It's going to create a way of distributing income to the people other than jobs or employment.
We don't have an argument.
Okay.
We do not
well,
have
that's
an
a huge thing. That you understand, we both agree. That's never brought up in the public dialogue.
That's fine. We completely agree on this. Now,
okay. So that's part of a vision that we should be thinking about outside of what's being proposed by our political candidates, including Mr. Obama and so forth. So we try to get them. Okay.
We're agreeing on this completely.
Now, maybe we should. Okay.
Now, labor theory of value. The clunkiest way in which that was put was by Karl Marx, who said the value of a thing is created only by the labor that goes into it.
They ended up calling it surplus value.
And that is, in this exclusivism is just wrong. Because if you don't do market research, if you don't create a product that fulfills a need, then nobody's going to buy it, then that doesn't help what labor went into that. So to just say the labor that goes into a product is the only thing that creates economic
wealth,
value. That creates
and
economic
value. Anything else is externality.
That's nonsense.
Yeah.
So what Henry George did, he bridged the classic labor theory of value with supply and demand, with the neoclassical, in saying it's not the labor that goes into a product, but the labor that is being saved, the labor that you are willing to give up for getting this product.
Okay, that's a way of doing it. We've been doing it. But
and that's a stroke of genius of Henry George. To my mind, there's no other economist who has done that.
Okay,
and now
very
we're coming,
good.
Now we're
yeah,
coming
now
to,
we got to get, now one last thing is supply and demand. How are the people going to have money to buy what can be produced in a Niagara proportions with technological augmentation? We have just one last little thing in terms of the time in which we live. We have not only weapons that are species lethal for the first time in 200,000 years, verified, modeled. On the other side, we have transcended at the level of capability in design, material scarcity as an ontologic reality, a biggie. That's never addressed. That's Fuller and some other thinker. You need to have a way for the buying power to be put in the hands of the people that is not related to their work, not related to their input, their ownership. And then you're going to end up, you know what you're going to end up with? You talk about autodidact. You're going to end up with people who are leisured, comfortably leisured, and maybe even better than comfortably leisured. And then you're going to need institutions that are not predicated upon the idea of a market value to every human activity. They're going to be leisured to leave the life of the mind and the spirit. Aristotle said, when they get to the point where the loom learns to weave, they can deal with the goods of civilization when they're material goods. A major species important level of transformation is taking place now. And the odds are, instead of doing that, instead of setting up a just order of liberated rather than enslaved people, we're probably going to blow it up with the weapons that we've developed technologically and go with entropy in the universe.
We better not.
Well, no, but it's not to be laughed off.
I'm not laughing it off.
Okay.
George's syllogism, all human beings have a right to live. Nobody can live without natural resources, so all human beings have the right to access natural resources.
That's beautiful in the abstract. That's beautiful.
It's not abstract. It's not abstract that you need to breathe.
That's a good metaphor.
It's not abstract that we need water.
It's not abstract. All 99.9% of the species that have ever existed have gone extinct in this universe, as far as we know. We get to a point where we've transcended materials. No, 99.9% of all species that have ever existed since 13.8 billion years ago when the organic evolutionary process
That's a long time.
That's right. But they've all gone extinct. And there's nothing, we cannot say that we now have this capability. We didn't have it in the Second World War. We were impotent out of 200,000 years as we were through all that time. Mm-hmm. But at a large level, thinking comprehensively, we now have modeling, and it works. Daniel Ellsberg brings it out beautifully, and everybody else. We set off the weapons now like we've been doing. Firebombing Tokyo, Vietnam with napalm. Keep doing that and doing that against an enemy that we're doing, and it's in the works now, Islamophobia, all this. If they do, it could be set off by any country. It's the end of the Homo sapiens species. It's time for a big change, like punctuated equilibrium appears.
Hell, we don't have an argument.
Okay,
arguing for warmongers? No.
No.
Let's go to this guy because
because he's important, and let's do that because we got about a few minutes now. He was a major figure, and you've written the foreword to this very good book, which I've read very carefully, and it seems to me he is criticizing the Stalinist view of communism.
Absolutely.
That held in East Germany where it was. Fill us in on this major figure. He's still living, but he's writing in a monumental way. Let me hold this up at a camera. They'll bring it in. You just talk to him. We got a DVD we want to show.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. You just talk.
So what happened here is there's a man who presides over the think tank behind the East German dictators.
Okay.
He's the head of the think tank behind the East German dictators.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a historian and economist, and his specialty is sources of Marxism, sources of communism, 19th century,
right,
worker philosophies.
Right. And that's the core of much of the left.
Yeah, that's the core of much of the left. And mm-hmm. what happened, unfortunately, is that it's called Demythologizing Marx, the book that shattered communism in Eastern Europe, Hermann von Berg. You can order it, lulu.com. You can go on Google Demythologizing Marx or the name of the author, you get it.
Yeah, and
it
you've
just
written
come
a forward
yes,
to this book,
yes,
a very well put together book.
Thank
yeah.
you.
Okay.
Now, Berg, when he did his research at Humboldt University in East Berlin,
uh-huh.
he realized, and he was a convinced Marxist, he was a kid, he was indoctrinated, so like everybody else, he thought Marx is the great savior.
Yeah.
And he's doing
50% of the world did.
Almost,
yeah,
almost.
Yeah.
So he's looking at the sources and he says, hey, wait a minute. There's nothing original in Marx. The Communist Manifesto is a plagiarized tract. Other people have said that better. In the French Revolution, there were people, Blanqui and so on, who said much better than Marx what's happening.
Oh, okay.
He looked at LaSalle, Born, Weitling, all the great labor leaders prior to Marx, and they all said better what Marx was trying to say. So Berg found out the guy's a plagiarizer and a copyist. And what happened tragically, much of the progressive thought, much of just society ideas were monopolized by the Marxists, by the Leninists, by the Stalinists, and for 150 years you couldn't do any kind of progressive thinking without either being demonized by the Marxists or becoming a Marxist
yourself.
And that's a disaster.
True.
In this sense,
and that should be rooted out.
Oh, completely. Yeah. And in this sense, people like Rosa Luxemburg, people like LaSalle, people like Robert Owen, many undogmatic thinkers who had like a larger view, non-dogmatic view, no big government view, no commanding economy view, Henry George, Friedrich List, Franz Oppenheimer, a whole bunch of people.
Friedrich List?
Friedrich List is a 19th century German economist who was big on, he's come down to us as a promoter of protectionism, but he was big on resources allocation.
Okay, there were that. Yeah, but the point being, and a lot of really good people, really good people who are really concerned with improving the least among us, one mark of the progressive agenda, were the leftist Marxists. Beautiful people. They were beautiful people really concerned with something other than making a whole bunch of money, like the capitalists were doing. And they had a critique of it that seemed to make sense. They called it scientific socialism. And they believed it. And they were good people. And they are. People that are there tend to be people that are concerned with the real social justice in a very real way. And much of the progressive contingent still hold with that. And that's something, if I'm not mistaken, still holds even though the Soviet Union imploded and all that.
Now, you can call them liberal Marxists, but now what Berg is actually saying is, I don't know if you want to run...
We've got about 12 minutes, so let's just a little setup to the DVD, and then let's underscore the fact that he was a Marxist, and then he saw the error of his ways, or what? And
Demythologized.
And the Marxist critique should not be repaired to so much by the people who are good. They should be thinking about new ways of seeing things that are not based on Marx, and I would submit the labor theory of value. That's even beyond Marx. That's beyond the whole way that society
Marx
is set up.
Marx is very big on the labor theory.
I know
he's one
was.
Of the main proponents.
And it still is intrinsic to the whole way in which the world is set up. Just think about it. That's the only way people think about getting money is through their labor participation.
No.
Demand and supply. You're not going to have the ability. They're going to be undercut. They're not going to be able to clear the market, because they think they have to have a job or they're contributing. They get identity and a better living wage or a minimum wage or something. And that's a problem that should be addressed by people who are seriously concerned about the plight of the human society with the inappropriate economic understanding of the world order at this particular moment.
I wrote a paper once, I think I mentioned it on your show, where Marx and Smith agree they're both wrong. And that would address all these issues.
Mm.
In leaving out nature, in leaving out natural resources, in leaving out proper natural resources allocation.
They're
rolling the cassette
please,
now. Okay,
please.
Let's see if we can see it. Let's roll this piece with Berg. And we're seeing ourselves still. Oh, here we go. Giltenberg. And we're going to have a little bit. You're going to comment over it. Okay.
So this is a Cold War thriller. The man who's behind the dictators realizes the system doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
He gets real numbers from the Kremlin under Andropov, who was like a forerunner of this Hermann von Berg.
Mm-hmm.
He's the forerunner of Gorbachev, of the whole thawing period, glasnost, perestroika of Gorbachev. There's Andropov, who is the mentor of Gorbachev, who wanted to open up the system, who wanted to open up a closed totalitarian system and make it fruitful.
Mm-hmm.
So Berg was given from the Kremlin the real numbers.
Mm-hmm.
He was given the real numbers of what the economy is actually producing, and he ran the numbers with friends, and he came up with, in the early 80s, he came up with By January 1990, the system at the latest will collapse.
Now, he did. Way ahead of everybody else.
Way ahead of everybody else. Mm-hmm. The system collapsed in November 1989. So the man was wrong by a month and a half over all these years.
That's amazing. Projected 10 years ahead.
That's it. I mean, they're saying in that, they're saying he was called the prophet of East Germany.
Because he can't show the fine print.
Yeah. He was not lying. Uh-huh. He, like everybody else, he was not rigging the figures. They were not dressing up their they were not cooking their books.
Mm-hmm.
So for this honesty, he was being persecuted. He was being...
Well, also criticizing the raison d'etre of the East German state.
He is building his house. He's building his house with his own hands. What happened was after he criticized Marx, they ousted him. They harassed his family. They took his house away. They expropriated his house. They expropriated the family.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually, in this book, is explaining that Marx goes back before the Enlightenment into some sort of inquisitional medieval ages stage of ideology.
Yeah, it got to be very Stalinistic.
Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. And it was exemplified in his life that the man is still alive. It's just is amazing.
Yeah, he is. He's about my age.
Yes.
You know? And he's living in Germany.
And outside Berlin. And to this day, he's fighting for his house in now supposedly a democratic West German system.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had people who would have opposed Marx, but they would have done it by saying they were great. The capitalist. He was a critique. So they were just saying all he's doing is being a running dog to the capitalist. That's what the Marxists would say.
Exactly. And here you have one of the.
Is that Howard Zinn?
No, that's one of the journalists who wrote on him from West Germany.
I can't see it from
the distance. And the other guy is a guy who represents the nomenclatura, the old nomenclatura, who wanted to make sure that a man who dare to criticize the holy Marx, that he will not, that he will just not get a leg on deck anymore, that he will not have a happy moment for the rest of his life.
Yeah, because that was the basic premise by which they organized the opposition to capitalism. When you had 50% of the world reading Karl Marx, was basis there. And then they did that. They were trying to rectify it and everything. But there were people. Another one is Ravi Batra, who was calling for a Great Depression and so forth. He was won awards. He did it by about 15 years, projected it. But it's interesting to me, the CIA, the intelligence agencies, all the major places where you divided everything up into tunnel vision views of things.
Tunnel vision.
Let me squeeze in
a word of how he became famous. He became famous in 1978 in smuggling out. There he is in smuggling out a. One of the Spiegel reporters, a friend of his, smuggled out an article that he wrote, in which he declares opposition, organized opposition within the Stalinist German system, an organized opposition against the one-party dictatorship.
Right, right.
And that was like a death sentence. And that he survived this is incredible. So that was published as Barrack's Manifesto, the Spiegel Manifesto in 1978, the first two issues of
the
Spiegel.
What year?
January 1978.
Okay, that's going back even a little
and
further.
And that became a big scandal, and he was arrested, he was put under interrogation. Willy Brandt himself, the chancellor, went on the phone and he said, if you do not let Barrack come back out, the detente between East and West will be finished.
Wow.
So the next day... Yeah. Barrack was out, and he was under the protection of the doves in the Kremlin, and he was under the protection of the West German politicians who were trying to bring an end to the Cold War. And he was the one, unlike anybody else, unlike the CIA, as you said, he was the one who predicted years and years ahead of the time.
Yeah.
This system will fail because it cannot survive because it's based on the wrong principles.
Right,
and
that's
this book, this book is making that point.
But very good, and you've written a very good foreword to it, and I appreciate that and everything. And that is undercutting. And the thing is that we're like here, MNN, and people who care for the least among us, mostly the people. I mean, because they're not been well served ever, and that we have a capability we're not realizing. And there are an awful lot of people who are enamored of what Karl Marx was saying, that it's the problem is the private ownership of the means of production, and it gets in the hands of a few people, and then they become like serfs to those people who own it. And then what happens, by doing away with the private sector, even, They did away, and so influence and power was in the government. No private sector. They wanted to privatize because that's an evil institution. We got to get over that.
Absolutely.
And so, is it possible to set up a system where and then China does the same thing? They're just running dog through the American pattern. The American pattern is inappropriate. They still hold with the idea that the only way you can get any legitimate income into the hands of the masses of the people, not the plutocratic leaders, that's like the Stalinists and so on, is for them to have a job, a labor relationship to production. We had to root that out. The way in which they should get income is to have ownership of a technological labor mix of production that is overwhelmingly productive, and they've got to have buying power in order to clear the market. The problem we have now is the people don't have money to meet the need to clear the market. So in terms of a systems understanding, they have to have buying power in the hands of the people, and it shouldn't all be tied to jobs because the jobs are being undercut. You get an algorithm that can displace, in market terms, 100,000 people, and then you can't do it through labor distribution. The labor theory of value informs all political systems, ours included, and it includes Mr. Obama and the Republicans and everybody, the way it's set up and the institutions. We got to deal with those in some sort of a way that's relevant to what the future requires. Henry George, I would submit Kelso and some others, are relevant to that, rather than going down the dead end of doing away with private property in terms of a Marxian critique. And Mr. Berg led that, and that we still haven't come to it yet.
I wanted to thank you. We are doing a commendable job in bringing out ideas and alternative thinking that is not been mainstream, and that's going to be the one kind of thinking that is going to rescue us from the nuclear holocaust, and that's going to rescue us from the devastation of the planet that we are getting into.
It may be that big. It's hard to do because it's certainly not going to be understood by anybody, because everybody who's in dire circumstances, how can I get a job? How can I serve on your estate? We do not question that. That's holy writ.
Henry George says we did away with ethnic slavery, but we have not done away with economic slavery, because
economic
our system
slavery
is wrong. We
absolutely
have economic slavery.
It is, and it's not working. They do it in China. They're going to be doing that, and it's coming that they're going to be. The bigger question is that we have, and that's a bigger issue. You could be put out in, the thing. Atomic weapons and binary bacteriological weapons unleashed in hatred, like we've been doing, species lethal. Everybody goes, okay? On the side of that, equally significant, on the positive side of that, is something that can't even be a SID. We have transcended material scarcity for ourselves and the ecology. Henceforth, we need systems relating to that future that's dawning, rather than reifying outdated institutions we've inherited out of a history.
We do not need to blow ourselves up. We are, for the first time in the history of the world, capable of feeding ourselves, of providing for all the needs of everybody.
Not only for the needs, but the wants and so forth.
Yes, no baby has to starve.
That's right. No baby, and the ecology.
And
we have the means of doing that through good design.
We don't have to destroy nature.
We need new institutions, and Henry George and Kelso and Fuller and all these other people are relevant to that. Thanks again for the book, for all the good work. Thank you for tuning in. We'll be coming back again tomorrow. That's it for this particular program. Kai, keep up all the good work. Great to talk to you always.